helping sprouts grow. In honor of this special day when we recognize and celebrate fatherhood, I offer to you some thoughts about being a dad. One definition of fatherhood is, a father is a man who carries photographs where his money used to be. Bill Cosby, I hope I can at least quote him a little bit, said, fatherhood is pretending that the presents you love most are soap on a rope. Joey Adams states, my father taught me everything about the birds and the bees. He didn't really know anything about girls. The first grade teacher asked one of her students if he knew his numbers. He said he did, that his father had taught him. Okay, the teacher said, let's see how much he taught you. The boy agreed. So the teacher said, what number comes after two? Three, the little boy answered. What comes after five? Six. What comes after eight? Nine. Well, the teacher was very pleased with the boy. Very good, praised the teacher. Looks like your father did a great job. So tell me, what comes after 10? A jack, the boy answered. Fathers, you gotta love them. For good or for ill, they seem to try and instill in their children the skills, attitudes, and observations they believe their children will need to succeed in life. When a home is without a father, or a father is abusive or neglectful of his children, it can all be felt profoundly by the children as they grow up. So even with many failings, fathers are still valuable and they are wanted. Now, I was thinking about fathers and being a father myself, and I wondered, what is the one thing I wish I had known right off the start at being a father? And I came to a startling and very humbling conclusion. Now, this will be a bit unsettling for some of you folks to hear, but the one thing I wish I had known when I began being a father was, fathers don't always know what is best. I know that's a big surprise to you. I mean, I'm sure that none of your fathers ever made mistakes or made bad judgments. Your fathers are probably the rare ones that were wise beyond their years, fountains of incredible knowledge and patient beyond belief. Your fathers, I am sure, never jumped to conclusions about what you were up to and never, ever overestimated or underestimated your abilities. Come on now. We dads, we're not perfect. We all know it. How many times have we said to ourselves, if only dad had been there when, even the very best fathers among us drop the ball occasionally, and some dads don't even bother to pick it up in the first place. We dads say we love our kids and we want what's best for them, but we still mess up. And of all the mistakes we make at being a father, the greatest one, maybe, is that we underestimate our children. Or even worse, we think we know exactly what is best for our son or daughter, for their future. Well, I've got news for all the dads out there. Sometimes, actually, maybe most of the time, we really don't know what's best for their futures. If you need any proof to the point, look no further than the relationship of King David to his father Jesse. Now, we have to be very careful we don't read too much into the story. The culture of that day was considerably different than the one we're accustomed to, and the family structure of Jesse's household would have been very foreign to us. The culture of the day was very patriarchal. In each household, the father was the lord and the master of the family. In fact, did you notice in the whole story of David, his mother is never talked about? Even though she gave birth to 8 boys, assuming it's the same mother for all the boys, not a word about her. And whether David had any sisters is really unknown to us, again, because of the patriarchal society. For many reasons, David was, to borrow a phrase from an old saint I used to know, that he was the tail end Charlie of the family. He was the youngest, and as such, his prospects were not great. His older brothers would inherit Jesse's wealth, and David would be forced to take menial jobs to survive or become a soldier. Being young, and it seems expendable, David was sent out to watch the sheep. Now, I said expendable because shepherding in those days was very dangerous work, as David's encounter with the lion and the bear have revealed to us. It would also be quite lonely work, but to his credit, David obviously used that time wisely in learning music. Maybe he used music to calm the sheep, but I suspect he used it to calm himself. As a youth and as the youngest, David's opinions were not sought at family meetings. And I'm sure his brothers all but ignored him. He would have been that pesky little brother that we all dread. So it's not surprising that when the prophet Samuel comes to honor the household of Jesse and anoint the future king, David isn't even summoned to the gathering. The presence of the great prophet of Israel was a big deal, and it was a real honor for the family. But whatever honor was to be bestowed on Jesse and his sons was not for David and Jesse's mind. I mean, why would a prophet care if the youngest of eight boys isn't even present? And so Samuel, not even aware of David's existence, goes about sacrificing to God and purifying Jesse's family as God had commanded him. Then he seeks to anoint the future king of Israel out of Jesse's boys. He meets the eldest, Eliab, and declares that this confident, very powerful man must be the Lord's choice. But it wasn't to be. God said to Samuel, "Don't judge by his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him." The Lord does not make decisions the way you do. The same goes for the other six sons that were present, and each is rejected. Well, Samuel's very confused. I mean, he's running out of candidates. And Jesse must be wondering, what is the prophet looking for? Out of frustration, perhaps, Samuel finally turns to Jesse and says, "Is this all of your sons?" And Jesse replies kind of nonchalantly, "Well, there is the youngest, but he's out watching the sheep." "Send for him at once," Samuel said. Upon seeing the young boy come into the family compound, this tail end Charlie, Samuel hears the Lord speak. "This is the one. Anoint him." And so in the presence of his seven brothers and his father and whoever else happened to be there, David is anointed by the prophet as the future king of Israel, and the Spirit of the Lord fell greatly upon David. As far as we know, neither Jesse nor David really was ever told what this whole thing was about. As Samuel returns to Ramah, life goes back to normal, and everyone scratching their head about this unusual situation that developed. Now, the only thing that comes about for a long time is that David comes to the court of Saul to play his harp to calm King Saul. King Saul in the scriptures is a very troubled soul. He was a reluctant king in the beginning, and it seems that severe depression haunted him. The only thing that seemed to make him feel better was music, especially the music David played. David, still in the eyes of everyone, was a young, musically gifted, mind you, boy from a backwater town of Bethlehem. Under normal circumstances, he wouldn't have even been a footnote in the history books at all. Now, that all changes, of course, when we encounter that famous story in the scriptures when Goliath, representing the Philistines, comes out calling out a representative from the Israeli army. This frightening guy is reported to be about 9 feet tall. His armor weighed 125 pounds, and his spear was the thickness of a weaver's beam and carried a 15-pound spearhead. His enormous size has led to all kinds of speculation about how he got that way, and the best answer that I've found was that scholars believe that his enormous size was due to a tumor on his pituitary gland that increased his growth rate. All I know is that he's a huge man, and he terrified everybody. Now, as we know, Goliath's strategy was to come out every day into the battlefield, which was a valley between the two armies, and he would offer to fight Israel's best warrior one-on-one. The idea that instead of hundreds of warriors battling it out, the future of the war would be decided by single combat. Now, it sounds simple enough, doesn't it? But who's going to fight this guy? Day after day, Goliath comes out and taunts Israel, King Saul, and of course God. And day after day, the Israelite warriors shrink back. Because of the war, David was not needed, of course, to play music for the king's court. So, once again, he's home, minding the family sheep. Therefore, Jesse tasks David with taking supplies to his three older brothers who are serving in the army. David arrives just as the army is taking their positions at daybreak. They never fought at night. And out of curiosity, he leaves his food gifts with a provision officer, and he goes off to find his brothers. And he soon hears Goliath making his daily taunt from the valley below. And he hears the Israelites running away, and he asks the obvious question, what's going on here? And the men tell him the story and add that Saul has offered a great reward to the one who goes out and slays that giant. The reward includes one of the king's daughters and tax freedom for his family. David cannot believe the story, so he actually goes around and confirms it with other people, and sure enough, it's the same story with everyone who talks to him, and he learns it's true. Now, David continues to walk among the troops, verifying the story, asking questions, and generally making a nuisance of himself. And Eliab, David's oldest brother, runs across him and angrily demands to know why he is there. And more importantly, who in the world's looking after the sheep back home? Obviously, the sheep were more valuable than David in Eliab's eyes. Eliab even criticizes David for, in his words, David was prideful and dishonest and just wanted to see the battle. He was rubbernecking, in other words. He had kind of a morbid curiosity. David wasn't dissuaded by his brother. He kept walking around asking questions. And somebody realized that David was King Saul's harpist and reported the fact that David was carrying on with his questions among the troops. Then, you know, young David comes and stands before the king. He's summoned there to answer why he's here, why he's doing what he's doing. And David boldly stands before the king and says, I'll go and fight that guy, that giant, Goliath. Well, Saul's response is the same as any one of us. He says, don't be ridiculous. You're just a boy, and that terrifying man has been a soldier since he was a boy. David, who eventually becomes an incredible warrior, actually, first encounter with warfare was this investigative journey he made to see his brothers. To support his effort to fight Goliath, David gives his resume to the king. He talks about his triumph over the bear and the lion, and he declares his faith that the Lord will deliver the giant into his hand. And Saul, realizing that no one else will even dare approach the giant, Goliath, and perhaps being just weary of the stalemate, allows him to go and fight. And you know the rest of the story, don't you? My point in all this is that David was sold short by everyone. His father Jesse, his brothers, and King Saul. No one expected anything from this boy except playing music and shepherding sheep. Yet what is most critical in this story is that the only assessment that really matters in this entire experience is the assessment God has of him. Remember what God said to Samuel? The Lord doesn't make decisions the way you do. People judge by outward appearance, but the Lord looks at a person's thoughts and intentions. Now Jesse thought he knew his sons very well. He knew what they could do based on life's experience and their appropriate ages. Sending the boy, David, to tend the sheep while his older three brothers were off at war was wise thinking, good management, I guess. Now, today we shudder at the tragic nature of child soldiering in this world. And even in David's eyes, no one would sanction using using a child to fight a battle, especially one against a huge man, a giant. As parents, we are constantly assessing our child's ability to engage in age-appropriate activities. A 2-year-old should not drive a car, nor should an 8-year-old take up smoking. Well, no one should, really. David's experience may be an exceptional one, but we should still be cautioned by the tale. God has a plan for our children, and it may indeed be true that God has not decided to reveal that plan to the parent, at least not now. The plan may even include going to places and taking on giants. And if we knew, as parents, we would apt to lock them up and throw away the key. But here comes the hard thing to accept. Whose sons were the 8 boys from Bethlehem in this story? Whose boys are they? Were they Jesse's sons? Were they Saul's because he's the king? Or maybe they were the sons of Israel. They may very well be Jesse's offspring, and as any good parent, he had authority over those boys. Likewise, Saul, who was the king, had authority over all his subjects. But David belonged to none of these people. His future was determined by God, and his anointing was a symbol of that. It was God's plan that mattered for young David, not Jesse's and not Saul's. It was God's assessment of David that mattered, not Goliath. As parents, we are constantly assessing our children. We wonder what their future will hold. We ask questions, don't we, about what career would be best for them? What schools should they go to? Even we start to sometimes wonder, who should they marry? All kinds of different questions about our children. We experience tremendous frustration when our best conceived plans for our children do not come to fruition. We beat ourselves up as if we're some sort of failure by not getting our kids to do what we feel is best for their futures. Let me suggest for a moment that we've got it all wrong. Maybe instead of insisting that our voice carry the most weight in our children's lives, we should, as they grow and mature, teach them how to hear God's voice. If they can hear God's voice, they are no longer prone to be overestimated or underestimated. If they can hear God's voice, they are no longer susceptible to the lies of the evil one that plants them in their minds, saying, you are not important. If they can hear God's voice through the clamor of all the other voices in this world, including our own, then maybe they can find purpose and, more importantly, peace. All our children will someday face giants. Those giants come in all kinds of different forms. They may be called financial pressure, career pressure, relationship pressure, and so on and so forth. And the reality is that we will not always be there to rescue them or try to force ill-fitting armor on them. But if we've done our job as parents correctly, they will possess the weapons they need to slay the giants in their lives. Not five stones in a sling, but with the strength and the presence of God. If it helps, think of your children as being anointed by God for His purpose and for His glory. As David said so boldly when he was facing Goliath, "The battle is not ours. The Lord will give you to us." I hope this incredible story of David inspires all parents to look at their children and see more than just a boy or a girl. Rather, I hope that we see in our children the hand of God directing them into a life of adventure where not even giants can stop them.